This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 11th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I am Markus Hippi and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House and The Monocle Daily. Coming up, we'll take a look back at our coverage of deadline-defying tales on Greece and Iran and this week's hopes for a ceasefire in Yemen.
There is no Yemen. It's finished. It will probably go back to a north-south Yemen, two countries that it used to be. And the Houthis can go back up north where they're all from, but I'm afraid there's a lot of killing to be done before that happens.
That's in a highlight from Midori House a little later. Plus, we'll hear about aviation in the Asia-Pacific. And before we go, we'll bring you a celebration of one of New York's finest department stores.
There's two different categories. One is fashion and designers who are making clothes for the consumer. But then there's these other designers who are working on such levels that you're beholding these clothes as sculpture.
All that and much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Markus Hippi. To start this episode of The Recap, let's turn to aviation. The level of competition among airlines vying for the Asian market has been heating up lately. At the Paris Air Show a few weeks ago, Garuda Indonesia announced its plans to step up its efforts on the international stage, ordering 90 new jets. Now China Airlines is expanding its network, adding a Taipei-Melbourne-Auckland route. On Monday's edition of The Briefing, Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck asked how likely this development is to make an impact on the aviation industry throughout Asia-Pacific. He was joined on the line by Aaron Young, Sky News Melbourne Bureau Chief.
There's about 30 different airlines now flying in and out of Melbourne Airport. This is just another, I think it's about the fifth Asian airline to fly to Melbourne from China, I should say. But you're right, what we have seen probably over the past 10 to 15 years in Australia is a real shift away from the European airlines to airlines from our own Asian Pacific region, as well as, of course, the United States. American Airlines and Qantas have just formed a significant alliance, which is similar to the Qantas and Emirates alliance as well. But then we are now starting to see a huge increase in the number of Chinese airlines that are starting to make their way to Australia. This started pretty much back in 2012. There was an agreement in 2013 between the Victorian government and the Chinese aviation industry to essentially allow more tourism, more business connections. Obviously, China is Australia's largest business partner, and for that reason, it's become an incredibly important aviation market. There's a very large Chinese population in Melbourne as well. Melbourne is the most visited tourist destination for Australians in the whole country. More people come to Melbourne than head to Sydney, even though Sydney perhaps is more famous on the world stage. This essentially is just another airline, I suppose, cashing in on that.
And tell me, also looking at the Australian market in particular, we've noticed over the last few years, you know, the rise also of the Gulf players who are kind of taking people up to the likes of Singapore and, you know, out of Australia. Are these airlines more, though, competing for, in a way, kind of local traffic, the traffic just within Asia, rather than trying to be, you know hub and spoke operators sending people then on to Europe or onto the US?
I think it's about being both. The Qantas and the Emirates alliance essentially is good for Qantas and Australian passengers in the sense that it opens a huge network once you get into Dubai from Australia to then head off to Africa or to head off to Europe. I think about two-thirds of the world's population is within about 8 hours from that destination of Dubai. So from that perspective, you're right about the hub and spoke. But I think that the Asian airlines, we've been flying, for example, Qantas used to go via Singapore off to London for that kangaroo route. That has now shifted significantly to the Middle East. Also, Virgin Australia, our other domestic airline here, has a significant ownership by Etihad. And so because of that, the Middle Eastern airlines have looked towards Australia as really one of the largest middle-class countries in the region with a very stable government, a very stable financial system as well. And perhaps for that reason, the Asian airlines are looking to get into it too. But this is, as I say, just one of five airlines coming to Australia, to Melbourne. And Melbourne's been trying to grow, while at the same time so many of the international airlines have been leaving Melbourne because they've been the old Alitalia style, the Olympic, the British Airways, who now have these partnerships with airlines like Qantas, etc., and they now no longer want to fly aircraft direct to Melbourne. What it has also meant is that the market to New Zealand has really put Melbourne and Sydney as well, I should mention, in the role of hub. Perhaps the biggest problem for airlines like Qantas and Virgin and any Australian airline in history is we're at the end of the line. These huge aircraft like an A380, it's very hard to fill that when you're going from a city like Melbourne or Brisbane. Sydney is not too hard because it has a huge international market, but because of the airline, the aircraft issues, it's meant that Melbourne and as I say, Brisbane have really struggled to become hubs. Now, a lot of these Asian airlines, Emirates as well in the Middle East, are really using Melbourne as a hub to get onto New Zealand, and that's what we're seeing here.
That was Aaron Young, Sky News Melbourne Bureau Chief, talking to Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck on Monday's edition of The Briefing. You are listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. And now to what this week seemed to be a tale of never-ending negotiation, with six world powers on one side and Iran on the other. One of the big questions people were asking over the past few days was, will we ever see an agreement on Iran's nuclear program? The initial deadline for striking a deal was the end of June, but that was then extended to Tuesday when I hosted The Globalist here at Monocle 24 and spoke to my guest Brazil Wagmar, a teaching fellow and member of the Centre for Iranian Studies at SOAS, University of London.
I don't think it could be found today. That's my surmise. Of course, I stand corrected if so. Because Kerry has to supply something by Thursday morning on the Hill, according to Coker and Company. Failure to doing so, which at least a copy of the deal, if it were to come to pass by this evening, that the deadline for scrutiny would be extended from 30 to 60 days. And that could be a potential for, you know, the deal to unravel because of the summer recess on the Hill. But putting that aside, the question is, we still have the final 10% to go, which is, of course, arduous. Now Tehran says that they want sanctions to be lifted on arms embargoes also. And on that, most of us, except Russia and China, are determined not to do so because it would only pour water over oils, what with Iraq, Libya, ISIS and other things flaring up as they would. But of course, Russia and China are pushing for that to be lifted, obviously because they have their own pockets to line.
So if you don't think that an agreement could be found today, what do you see happening next then?
Well, another deadline as such, maybe just a few more days, if at all, to spill into. But I don't see this festering forever, as it were. But it could just about pass today, so to speak.
Could you try to explain what's happening behind the scenes over there? It seems to be taking a lot of time. So what are those small steps that are being taken?
For example, what has been agreed as part of the interim April agreement now stands and will be copper-bottomed. 6,104 centrifuges will be permitted. Originally, there were 19,000, so now they're down to 6,104. And Tehran has committed itself that of this, 5,000 will continue enriching uranium, and of that, only first-generation centrifuges will work, which, of course, is a slower and unreliable process. But having said that, Tehran itself has also informed us that they have developed second- and third-generation centrifuges. But, of course, we have to take their word for it, that they won't be implemented. I mean, as President Obama himself said, the 10-year period is a window to prevent breakout. But come year 13 or 14, it will practically come down to zero. And remember, after year 10 of the deal, if something is signed today or in the next few days, they will be permitted to enrich further uranium. And after year 15, the program is completely unbridled.
Earlier, the impression was that Iran's president Hassan Rouhani was really willing to cooperate, to go quite far with that approach. What kind of position is he finding himself now, considering that it is Iran's supreme leader, Khamenei, who actually has the final say in these matters?
And he always did from day one, come to think of it. Rouhani has to tread on eggshells. What with parliamentary elections due in February 2016, and a parliament that has been top-heavy with conservatives and fundamentalists, I should say, since 2004. And there are rumblings that the hardliners will not obviously key in. And I'm talking about elections on the horizon, as it were. But Rouhani has to steer a very clear course and a very cautious one at that.
And when you look at those forces that President Rouhani is facing, how are they affecting these negotiations, and how can Rouhani try to find an agreement with the other countries?
Well, they are egging on the fact that the West is a bunch of unreliable sorts, and that they will not commit, honour their commitment, their part of it, of lifting off all the sanctions, which is simply not true. We will commit ourselves. Look, they've already received interim relief since November 2014. 500 million worth of oil transactions were permitted with South Korea, and payments were permitted, Seoul paid to Tehran for that. Ultimately, it progressively works out that they will have access to the 4.3 billion in restricted foreign bank central accounts, which they are dying to have at present. But that will only come with their commitment down the road, because we don't want a deal that would, quote, empower bad behavior.
And just finally, before I let you go, let's recap what you said earlier. So you don't think an agreement will be found today, but it may be found later?
I should imagine so.
Burzin Wagma there, from the Centre for Iranian Studies at SOAS here in London, speaking to me on Tuesday's edition of The Globalist. You're listening to The Recap. It's time now for a highlight from Tuesday's episode of The Monocle Daily. Now, every day here on Monocle 24, we have been following the Greek crisis, as after last Sunday's referendum, the country's been trying to strike a cash-for-reform deal with creditors to save the state from bankruptcy. Earlier this week, EU officials said they had yet received no fresh offer from Greece on how to solve its debt problem, but it was understood that Athens was preparing to make another request for an EU bailout. In contrast to the absolutist stance of the ECB and the IMF, the Eurozone's leaders seem to be somewhat softening theirs. France's François Hollande said his country would do all it could to keep Greece in the euro, and Angela Merkel suggested that enough goodwill remained. On Tuesday's edition of the Monocle Daily, Emma Nelson and Andrew Müller were joined by Benedict Pavia from France 24 and Henning Meyer, editor-in-chief of Social Europe, who gave their views.
The French president is just answering questions as we speak. Angela Merkel spoke before him. And what is interesting is he is stressing the fact that this summit today was absolutely, he says, not only necessary, but indispensable to re-establish the dialogue and to re-establish, he said importantly, trust. He says that France absolutely, he reiterated, and it's not a surprise that he wants Greece and France wants Greece to stay in the Eurozone. But he then said, and it is for the Greeks to express themselves. French president went on to say, he specified, they'd already expressed themselves in the referendum on Sunday, but he then specified we need the Greek political parties to express themselves. And then he made it very clear that there was now a very firm timetable. And what the French president was reiterated again and again before his Q&A was time now is very short. We cannot afford to waste any more time. So as of tomorrow morning, the Greeks have agreed, he says. So obviously he's referring to not only the Prime Minister Tsipras, but also the new foreign finance minister, to make very concrete proposals that on Thursday, those proposals, the Greeks will then flesh out, the French president says, those proposals. And that then that would enable the Eurogroup to meet on Saturday, and then that would mean that the heads of government could then meet and make a decision on this on Sunday. Of course, Henning will tell us more about, I think, that Angela Merkel would need to get the approval of the German parliament. The French president then very briefly went on to enunciate three principles. They are responsibility, solidarity, and speed. And he says that solidarity is linked to responsibility. He's saying very much that the Greeks must really now, you know, provide some real measures that can be examined by everyone. There is no time to lose, he once again said. And so he seems very firm that a deal is still possible. And this all while there is really a left, a socialist government, a socialist party, and a right-wing split, but we can come on to that, within France about about Greece.
So, Henning, we have a timetable now that has been laid down by the heads of state. To what degree are we getting to the stage now? As François Hollande said, France wants Greece to stay. Are they still going to try to adhere to this political vision that it has been argued that was created by Kohl and Mitterrand in 1989 with any real idea of actually the economic consequences that would come and bite them later down the line?
Well, I would love to see a deal, but unfortunately the vibe I get from this meeting is much more negative. If you look at the remarks of especially the Eastern European finance ministers in the afternoon, they were talking about cutting out a dysfunctional part of the system. And also, if you look at the remarks of Juncker and Tusk, and also Angela Merkel apparently said that she still sees no basis for a third programme.
That's right. Yeah.
So, and given that there needs to be unanimity, and the fact that the Greeks now have until Thursday morning at the latest, that's what I've heard, to get through a proposal officially asking for ESM money. And on Sunday, there will be a full EU summit, not just the Eurozone leader summit, a full EU 28, which is basically suggesting that they're preparing for the worst, that because, you know, if there was some sort of humanitarian aid, that would be a full EU matter rather than a Eurozone matter. So the fact that they are assembling a group of 28 rather than just the Eurozone suggests that they are actually planning for a potential Grexit. That's very unsettling.
You could flip it on its head, though, and say that they're preparing to bring all member states together to actually help, as opposed to push out.
Help in what way?
In sort of humanitarian aid and a drive to unite to actually save Greece, to stop it from exiting.
Yes, but I mean, humanitarian aid is an EU-wide matter, but Eurozone help, the actual financial package, is ESM. That's a Eurozone matter, so you wouldn't need the full 28.
It tells us something, I guess, as well, that we're even using the phrase humanitarian aid in reference
to
a member of what's supposed to be the world's richest trading bloc.
Well, it's a very sad set of affairs.
People don't have their insulin. People are begging for what is their daily medicine. I mean, this is inconceivable in 2015 in an EU country.
That was Benedikt Pavia from France 24 and Henning Meyer, Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe, speaking to Emma Nelson and Andrew Müller on the Monocle Daily on Tuesday. Up next, a look at Yemen.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You are listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. Now, Yemen has offered little good news in recent months. A war between Iran-sponsored Houthi rebels and a Saudi-backed government, with involvement also from the so-called Islamic State and the local Al-Qaeda franchise, has left thousands dead or displaced, and the country on the verge of humanitarian disaster. But on Thursday we heard that, according to the Houthis news agency, a ceasefire would be agreed within 24 hours. On that day's episode of Midori House, Andrew Müller got the view of his guests Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and Tim Marshall, editor of thewhatandthewhy.com and the author of Prisoners of Geography.
How optimistic should we be about this?
Very, because it's the only hope in town. Very, because what they're looking at is a humanitarian truce, not ending of the war. If you're a real optimist, you think, okay, if they could just get 3 to 5 days peace, no more bombing, no shooting, get a shed load of humanitarian aid in, and whilst they're doing that, 5 days of calm, they can actually start talking and then they can get a proper peace deal. what has happened in the past is that it's broken down or it's come to the end of its 3 days and they've started shooting again. That is probably what will happen unless there is more to this. Because there are some conditions. For example, if you want to extend it, the Houthis have to release the defence minister, the former defence minister who they've captured. It's got to be a big exchange of prisoners. The problem is that the outside powers haven't finished yet. I think the Houthis and the government forces can probably come to an arrangement within themselves. But outside, Iran and Saudi Arabia and others are pushing, and I don't think they've finished their fight yet. So until they've all agreed that they're not going to push anymore, it will probably be a temporary ceasefire. Let's hope I'm wrong.
Sebastian Borger, those conditions that Tim mentioned are among those being dictated by Yemeni President Abid Rabu Mansour Hadi, who has been in exile in Saudi Arabia for some considerable time now. Does he still matter at this point? I mean, he is officially the president of Yemen. The UN Security Council has passed a resolution recognising him as same or upholding him as same. But one could argue that when you need the UN Security Council passing resolutions reminding everybody that you're president, you've got fairly big problems, haven't you?
That is true. But it is still a some sort of authority, isn't it, the Security Council? So, yes, I think he does matter and he needs to be at the table and they need to, as Tim says, get down and find a space to talk. That's all we can ask for. We'll hope they'll get that.
There is no Yemen. It's finished. It will probably go back to a north-south Yemen, the two countries that it used to be. And the Houthis can go back up north where they're all from, but I'm afraid there's a lot of killing to be done before that happens.
Are the Houthis likely to give up what they have in the south?
Yeah, I think they would for the right deal, yeah, especially if you give them the capital. The capital of the ex-country of Yemen, which actually still exists on paper.
Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and Tim Marshall, editor of thewhatandthewhy.com and the author of Prisoners of Geography, speaking to Monocle's Andrew Müller. You are listening to The Recap on Monocle 24, and before we go, time for something a little different. This week on The Globalist, we have been taking a look at some of the world's most luxurious department stores, including in New York City, where what started out as a tailor's in downtown Manhattan back in 1899 is now one of the world's most stunning retail destinations. Bergdorf Goodman is widely considered the ultimate career peak for a designer, playing host to such names as Chanel, Gucci, Yves Saint Laurent, and Tom Ford. But beyond its collection of luxury goods, Bergdorf's also reigns for its ability to maintain a carefully cultivated reputation amongst its discerning clientele. Matthew Mierley played a role in that when he directed the documentary Scatter My Ashes at Bergdorf's. Here he talks us through the making of the film and his thoughts on the store's appeal.
I noticed people have a connection to the store because it's generational. The fact that it is so old, it's the whole notion of my mother used to come here, all the way to my great-grandmother even used to come to Bergdorf's. So it's part of a family tradition for, I would say, the 1%. Because obviously, if you don't know, people spend gobs of money there. It's the most expensive store, I would say, maybe in the world. The fact also that it's a signature store, it's not a chain, I think there's a fascination there because people seek it out. You have to come to New York to go. And I think that's part of the attraction. Similar to a Selfridges or other iconic stores, like a Harrods. But Bergdorf's has an appeal because it's multifaceted. There's a restaurant on the 7th floor. You can spend a day there and not be bored. It's not like going to a mall and you go to all these different stores. It's like, this is its own iconic Fifth Avenue address. It's right in the heart of Tourist Central. I mean, it's at the four corners of Fifth Avenue, which they say is the four corners of the world. Tiffany is catty corner to it. All your big designer brands end up at the top of Fifth Avenue there. And Bergdorf's is just standing there as this lone store, beautiful building that dates back to 1929, I think it was built. And you have this day you can spend with your family or with your best friend or with your fashion aficionado, you know, your fellow fashion aficionado, and go through the store and just have a great time. You don't have to buy anything, you can try on, but you know, ultimately you have a bastion for fashion lovers. Half museum, in my opinion, half museum where you see current and classic clothing. But for a consumer or a customer, it's as good as it gets. Fashion director is Linda Fargo, and she was a character in the film. We followed her, and you know, the way she curates the clothing is key, because she doesn't want the people who do it as a hobby. She doesn't do a selection of clothing from the designer who has a bunch of money and is just doing it on the side. These are people who are found not because they graduated here, or they had a hit here or hit here. It's more a longer view of fashion. They want to make it their life. It's their passion. And I had a firsthand look at it, obviously, because she let us film her reviewing them. Some got in, some didn't. Bergdorf's isn't reliant on the next sale. They have a lot of money. They're backed by a huge company. I think the people that are selling the clothes aren't running up to you hoping they can help you pick something out so they can make their sale. They really care about their consumer or their client. But they're also brutally honest. This one personal shopper we met named Betty, she became the standout in the film, and she has this really raw personality when it comes to being honest and not pulling any punches if she doesn't think it works for someone. She has very caustic friends, or had one in Joan Rivers, who was interviewed for the film, came for Betty because of Betty and had been dressing her for years. Candace Bergen was also a client, and she again is another type of woman who's no holds barred, no pulling punches. She subscribe to that same mentality of trying on clothes and, you know, what looks good, what doesn't look good, tell me the truth. I think there's an intimidation factor for a lot of people. I think they know it's expensive. I think they've heard about the people that shop there. But in my estimation, when you walk in, because the dark secret is I never had been there prior to filming. It was all a mystery to me. So as I figured it out and I became curious, that's kind of the trip I take the audience on. But the museum thing, I say that because in fashion, in my opinion, there's two different categories. One is fashion and designers who are making clothes for the consumer that are, they're trendy, but they're flash in the pan clothing. But then there's these other designers who are working on a museum type level, where it's clothes that should be featured in a museum. You have the Oscar de la Renta's of the world. You have Armani, you have all these great designers, and younger designers too, working on such levels that you find that you're beholding these clothes as sculpture. You're looking at them like they are, you know, they should be celebrated and not just worn, but kind of highlighted.
That was Matthew Mieli, director of Scatter My Ashes at Bergdorf's. Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode of The Recap. The show was produced by Alice Block and edited by Toby Hammond. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programmes here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Markus Hippi, thank you for listening and goodbye.